an energy transition is, you know, the process of transitioning from one energy source to the other. When we talk about these transitions, I think we have to tap into different sorts of innovations, yeah, that are suitable for our context, suitable for our continent, and not think that just because the North is transitioning in a certain type of way, then that applies to us. Decarbonization is very important. It's important not only for South Africa, it's important globally because, you know, we can see the effects of climate change. So for us to have an energy transition, it has to ensure that people have affordable, accessible, modern energy services that they can use that are suitable for their context and their conditions.
Hello and welcome to Earthcast, a platform for discussions about bridging the resource gap between people and planet. I am your host, Olivia Taylor, or Olivia Earth on the socials. I will be interviewing a series of changemakers, thinkers, and disruptors, and asking them about their fields of interest. Together, we will discover fresh perspectives and the most useful levers in society for change. More specifically, we will look at how to solve wicked problems and make decisions at the margin. If you would like to hear more from Earthcast, click subscribe and follow us on social media. Earthcast Season 1 explores the just energy transition and unpacks varied topics such as policy, finance, deepening inclusivity, innovative technology, and how to accelerate the transition given climate limitations. I'm excited to be welcoming you back to Earthcast for episode 22, where I feel very privileged to be speaking to Dr. Ntabiseng Mohlakuana, who is a senior researcher at the Center for Sustainability Transitions, or CST, at the University of Stellenbosch. She has published some articles and book chapters on energy access and use, productive uses of energy in the informal food sector, and addressing gender issues in energy governance and access. Ntabi has 20 years of experience in research focusing on energy policy implementation, energy access and use, as well as gender mainstreaming in the energy sector. At CST, she is part of the energy team working on the South African energy transition, with a focus on the socio-economic issues, such as energy access, energy poverty, jobs, skills development, gender, as well as impact on communities and their livelihoods. Most of her research in recent years emphasizes the importance of gender equality in planning and implementation of energy and other basic service interventions dictated by policies, in line with the SDGs and other important intervention strategies. Ntabi's work aims at finding solutions that address and lead to the eradication of energy poverty and addressing inequalities in the global south. So a huge thank you for joining us today, Ntabi. We actually met while I was studying renewable energy policy at the CST's Sustainability Institute in Stellenbosch, and I was quite taken by the level of consideration and gentleness in Ntabi's delivery and question and answering. So without further ado, would you mind sharing your personal journey exploring in the energy sector, gender equality in planning and implementation, and why you think it's a useful place for you to apply your skills and enthusiasm?
Hi, Olivia. Thank you very much for inviting me into your space on Earthcast. I find it exciting and well done on having this platform. So my personal journey is quite a long one, especially into the energy sector. First of all, I never thought that I would fit into the energy sector because I thought that it was something that could be done with people that have an engineering background or a degree. So I was quite surprised when I was at the University of Cape Town doing my undergraduate in social anthropology and sociology. And I came across this organization called the Energy and Development Research Center. And I started working there as just a student support doing some admin. And they had a small library there. and I was sorting out some reports, and something caught my eye. And I could see that it was a report on household energy use. And as I flipped through one of those reports, it was as if it was describing my background, the conditions that I grew up under, my home, my grandmother's home in Soweto. It was talking about multiple fuel use in low-income households, talking about how people are using coal while they also rely on paraffin, and while they also have access to electricity, and they would also use candles. And it was just describing the conditions that I grew up under, the conditions that I knew I was very familiar with, the conditions that I went back to when I visited my grandmother. So I started asking around, you know, is this what is done in this place, this kind of research? You're talking about issues that I'm familiar with, issues that I can understand, issues that I'm interested in, issues that I would become a researcher for. And that was the drive for me, because from that moment on, I don't remember wanting to be anything else but an energy and development researcher. This is what I wanted to do. This is what I wanted to find out. I was curious about the researcher's curiosity around these issues. But I also, when I was reading this report, some of the information was not accurate, because I guess it was written by people that were not living through that situation. So, there were questions about why are people not using grid electricity and continue to use coal and paraffin? Is it an issue of poverty? Is it that people don't trust electricity? Is it that it's expensive? And I remember those answers are not easy to understand. Each household has their own response. Nowadays, it's mostly blamed on poverty, on energy poverty. But I remember that my grandmother used her primer stove, the paraffin, because she wanted to cook certain types of food with it. But at the same time, the coal stove would be on, especially in winter, because there was soup on the stove. And so that was ideal, and that couldn't be cooked on a primer stove because it would take long. The electricity was used because we needed light, and we used that. And we hardly ever used the electricity heater because, yes, it was more expensive, but it hardly made the house warm. So we had a coal stove. So you could, an appliance like a coal stove had so many uses, which was appreciated by people, but not to say that they didn't appreciate grid electricity, which was somehow how it was represented in some of these reports. So it was also just to try and set the record straight, but also just it built my interest, because then it could get me access to these issues that I was also interested in. You know, I wanted to find out if people are not using, modern energy services, and it is because of affordability issues, what is it that we can do or the government can do to make sure that, people are able to access grid electricity the way that they should or afford it. And of course, as I went on with this work, I realized that gender equality was quite important as well, because you found that the managers of households were women. Women were mostly unemployed, had to stay at home, look after the kids, look after the home, cook. In rural areas, they would be the ones that are collecting wood. in urban areas, they would be in charge still of cooking. Even if maybe they send their children to go and buy paraffin, the money would come from, so that budget would be made by them. Even if maybe the money came from their husbands or males in the home, they would be the women would be the ones making decisions, particularly for cooking fuels or cooking energy. And there was that also that the gender division that was really clear from the onset, especially where households we had male and female, where men would favor, you know, entertainment appliances, like wanting to buy a TV first and a hi-fi system, whereas the woman would say, oh, when I get my stock sell money or when I get paid, I'm going to invest in a stove or, you know, an appliance for a home that would benefit everyone with regards to nurturing. So that built my interest as well in this, you know, gender issues around energy services. And that didn't stop there with gender issues, because you also, then the issue of participation in the energy sector, you found that even though there were a whole lot of women that were employed in the energy sector, they still dominated the administration positions, unlike men that were technicians and all of that. So how do you ensure that women also take decision-making spaces within the energy sector, and that they contribute particularly to policies, especially if it is women that are using, you know, household energy in this kind of ways? So this is why I think actually my research and the work that I do is quite useful. It's useful for me. It fulfills, I kind of feel like I'm fulfilling my purpose on Earth as one of the people that contribute to a greater understanding of how we tackle some of these issues that are so complex that sometimes feel like they are not changing. And sometimes when you think that things are changing, some of them just get so worse because of different events that happen. You know, like last year we had COVID, or the past 2 years, and that changed the face of energy poverty a lot, where you think that, you know, you now have a hold on what is happening. You are understanding the dynamics around energy poverty, and something like COVID-19 comes and people lose jobs, people lose their homes, people lose their livelihoods, and they have to go back quickly to depending on traditional energy sources, and which, you know, makes them vulnerable, exposes them to ill health, and, you know, exposes them to the cold, extreme heat, and they are not able to do anything about that because they cannot afford the energy or energy services that can help them with that. Yeah, I hope that answers your question, Olivia. I know the answer is so long.
And Tabby, I so appreciate your vulnerability and sharing such a personal story.
Yeah, the only way I can explain it.
So for question two, would you mind giving a brief breakdown of what an energy transition is in a global context? And the reason I'm asking this is because I want to know, what are the enabling factors for a deep and just transition? And then alternatively, or on the other hand, what are the barriers to this?
I wouldn't say it's a difficult question. Well, it's a complex, it's not a question that one can answer so easily. Well, first of all, just a breakdown of what an energy transition is just, you know, the process of transitioning from one energy source to the other. In this case, in this global context, then, you know, with the concern of climate change and all that, we have to transition from fossil fuels to low carbon energy sources. which is renewable energy. Yeah, and that is happening. We see it a lot in the global north happening. And because there is a system to enable that, there is money to enable that to happen easier than it is in the global south. First of all, when we talk about these transitions, there's an assumption that people will have to stop using fossil fuels and go straight into renewable energy services. But if you take the context of the global south, for instance, let's just take the African continent. How many people have access to electricity, grid electricity, that is generated by use of coal? Very few, more than 50% actually, I think, of the sub-Saharan population does not have access to grid electricity. It's just there, that's just a fact. So when we are expecting this transition to happen as smoothly as it is happening in the global north, then I think we are missing the point because the context is different. You already are dealing with people that do not have access to modern energy services. They are already using energy resources to the minimum, you know, because this is what they can afford. Yes, the energy sources that they're using are not the best because they're using traditional energy sources and depend on wood and, you know, biomass. But yeah, and for them to transition, that transition would be from, you know, transitioning from traditional energy sources to modern energy sources. And then what would be those modern energy sources? It's not only about providing PV systems or, you know, wind-generated electricity, but also about the appliances that people are using, because we know that with providing PV or solar systems, if we want them to be at a capacity where people are able to cook with those systems, then, you know, a whole lot of money needs to be put down. And we're talking about people that do not have that money to invest in those kinds of systems. So, yes, you would be providing some energy, clean energy to them in terms of lighting, maybe in terms of other appliances, smaller appliances like TVs and radios, and maybe even a small refrigerator. But the issue that remains difficult to resolve is the issue of cooking. What do you do with that? Because people still continue to use wood, to use charcoal to cook, because they cannot afford, you know, things like LPG or even afford to get grid electricity. So that's where we have to turn to what are the best appliances. Maybe a clean cook stove would be one of those. And I think we have to tap into different sorts of innovations here that are suitable for our context, suitable for our continent, and not think that just because the North is transitioning in a certain type of way, then that applies to us. Maybe in the context of South Africa, because most of our electricity is generated from fossil fuels. You know, we have the state utility, Eskom, that is generating that. And maybe that puts South Africa in a kind of a similar position as the other northern countries. But we know that when you go down to the ground, the situation is different. We have at least about 50% of people living in energy poverty in South Africa. We have high rates of unemployment. We have inequality. We have all these issues that we are faced with, which in the northern countries are different, or they are not at the extremes that we are experiencing or what we have in our country. So for us to have an energy transition, it has to be a just one. We just cannot have it any other way. It has to be a just one in that it has to ensure that people have affordable, accessible energy or modern energy services that they can use that are suitable for their context and their conditions. It has to make sure that people are able to, you know, have jobs, to be able to keep those jobs. Those jobs have to be sustainable. It has to be able to ensure a clean environment for people, a rehabilitated environment for people. It has to contribute to our education to ensure that the youth is employable. It has to create job opportunities, whether it's through the existing small enterprises that we find in the townships and in communities, or ensure that, you know, whatever industries that we go into as part of the renewable energy-led industrialization is able to provide jobs and livelihoods for people that are affected the most by the unjust energy distribution and the way that it has been going over the past years. Yeah, and I think the barriers to ensuring a deep and just transition, there's quite a lot. There's the financing part. There's also, I think, the motivation for that different actors have in this space. You know, who wants to have an energy transition? What is it that they want it for? We have, you know, developers that are in it, you know, for profits and all of that. And we also have programs that are ensuring or trying to ensure that, you know, the transition is happening in a just way. But, you know, if the policies are also not providing a conducive space for the transition to happen in a just way, then you also have a problem, you know, with the governance of it all. So, I mean, the barriers are many. There's also the barrier, which is if you do not involve all the local stakeholders or all the stakeholders equally so that all the voices are on the table, then that could be a huge barrier to actually ensuring that the transition is just. If only a few voices are heard and those voices determine the decisions to be made, a whole lot of people can lose out and the transition will definitely be unjust.
Following that, would you mind explaining how the just energy transition fits into an African context and its potential for growth in the space?
Yeah, I think I have touched on that a bit. You know, particularly in the African context, we have to ensure that the energy transition is just in a way that it benefits not only single countries, but it benefits the whole continent. We could start with the grid expansion. I mean, if you take, for instance, Europe, a lot of issues around power and power supply are not so much of a problem because of the connectivity, you know, of the grid connectivity. Yes, Europe is a smaller continent, but in the African continent, I mean, we could start there to ensure that there is grid connectivity so that we're able to share the resources. I mean, we already have the sun and the wind, but in order to be able to harness those and ensure that we share that we share those resources in a way that will lead to growth and, you know, economic development for our countries. I think it's important to consider, the grid connection for the continental grid connection. It's quite important. And that would be able to deliver a just energy transition, because we can think of the jobs that could be created. You would be able to also be able to generate income and ensure that people are employable. It would change the face of the African continent, I think. But also, you know, that the way that we rely on fossil fuels and biomass and all of that, that is leading to, you know, deforestation and all of that, which is also quite a big concern for our continent. So if we harness what we have, you know, but of course we need innovative ways to do that. We need the technology. So there is a need to invest in that for our continent in order for it, or for us to see the potential for growth. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And quickly, I want to talk about your role on the energy team, which is working on the South African energy transition. What have you found to be the most exciting findings regarding addressing the dual goals of decarbonization and development?
I don't know about exciting, but I have found that the important thing about, you know, addressing these dual goals of decarbonization and development is not to forget what we mean by development. And not to forget the people that we are doing this for. Yeah. Yes, decarbonization is very important. It's important not only for South Africa, it's important globally, because, you know, we can see the effects of climate change. We have seen the damage not only in South Africa, but, you know, throughout the world. There is something happening that is a natural disaster that can only be explained by the impacts of climate change. And that's quite important. But I think, I mean, my work, what it has revealed to me is that there is a need to advocate very, very hard, aggressively, actually, for the people that are sidelined in decision-making around this energy transition process. And there are a lot of people that are sidelined. There are a lot of voices that are not heard. And some of those voices are not heard because they do not have the capacity to stand on the podium. If you think of, you know, like participate in these processes, we've seen the PCC processes and all that. Not everyone has the ability to participate in those. And so we miss out on a lot of what could be said and decisions that could be taken for people, and by the people, that we end up missing out quite a lot of the important stuff, which ends up just addressing one part of the problem, and the other part is left unaddressed. And I think that has been very important for me. So I guess the exciting part is realizing that there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done there, and trying to map, I think, my role in this whole issue, to see what is it that my research can offer with regards to, you know, the actor participation, who are the important actors and what their decision making leads to, and how important that is, and how it influences the process going forward. So, yeah, I think the excitement is the unknown, trying to figure it out, taking the context, this very complex context of South Africa.
And Tabby, thank you so much for joining me today. And unfortunately, we have to start wrapping up our interview or our chat, I guess. And I just wanted to thank you again for telling such a personal story and really doing such a vulnerable deep dive. And for the audience, those of you listening who would like to follow more of Ntabi's work, you can follow her on the Center for Sustainability Transitions website, which is www.zero.sun.ac.za/CST/. Or you can follow more of Ntabi's work on LinkedIn. So Ntabi, given your expertise, what question should I have asked you?
Oh, I don't know. I've been trying to think of this question for quite some time.
Everyone panics. Everyone panics. Don't worry.
Yeah, maybe a question about you know, do I feel that my work makes an impact? I think that's the question you should have asked me. Tabby, do you think that your work is making an impact, a positive impact?
And if I did ask you that question?
I would say it depends. It raises some awareness, sometimes with the right people, sometimes with people that really do not have decision-making powers and, you know, policy-making power, policy-changing or policy-making powers. But I think it does shift something when people get to know or people get new knowledge, you know? It just piques your curiosity and you think, oh, okay, so this is what is happening. Maybe we should do something more about it. Yeah, I think it raises awareness. And when it gets to the right ears and to people that are willing to make a change, then that change is made. The one that I'm still proud of was quite early on in my career when Eskom approached us and they were asking about how is it that they can ensure that low-income households use the electricity that they are provided, you know, that they are provided with, because Eskom had just electrified so many households in the 90s. But we're just so confused by why people were not using it, particularly in the rural households and low-income households. They thought maybe people were stealing it and not paying, or maybe there was something wrong with the metering. And of course, we were called in as social scientists in this energy area and to go in and look, because the numbers were not telling Eskom anything. They were just telling them that, you know, the people are not using as much electricity as you thought that they would. And when we got there, you know, those background stories that gave meaning to why people are using electricity that they are, that took me back also to the early days when I discovered these reports about, you know, how information was misinterpreted, how the findings were misinterpreted. And we found out that, you know, there were issues of cost people were not able to afford, or people used electricity only on special occasions, or some use of electricity clashed with cultural values and all of that. So, but at the end of that project, what we recommended was that if you want people to be at least have access and use electricity, provide them with an electricity subsidy. And that was the birth of what we have now as the free basic electricity subsidy. Started out as a pilot, and then it was taken up by government because they could see that it relieved some energy poverty in most of the low-income households.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe and leave a review. Let's chat next episode, where I will be asking more creatives and intellectual disruptors about making decisions at the margin. See you next time.